From WVUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. As the Major League trade deadline approaches and teams scramble to trade for a hot young pitcher, ESPN's Tim Kirkjian extols the virtues of the old guy with a funny pitch. Also, the Detroit Shock absorb a rather bumpy season, and the dudes go bowling. And 1 week after capturing her third Wimbledon title, Serena Williams responds to controversy regarding the placement of prettier players at center court.
Obviously, I feel like I'm super hot. I don't think you can get better than my body, so let's face it, you know.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. I wish I had some pitchers, for I'd receive fine offers from GMs happy as can be to open up their coffers. Why? Because it's the time of the summer when the general managers of teams likely to contend have suddenly discovered again the truth of that old baseball cliche, you can't have enough pitching. Joining me now to discuss what might transpire as a result, as well as other baseball matters, is ESPN's Tim Kirkjian. Tim, welcome back to the program.
Great to be back, Bill.
Toronto general manager J.P. Ricciardi said this week that he would be open to trade offers for Blue Jays ace Roy Halladay. Halladay is a five-time All-Star. He's off to a 10-3 start this season. Which teams are likely to pursue him?
Well, there are several teams, Bill, led by the Phillies, who are the defending world champs and have had really awful starting pitching most of the season. The Phillies have young players to trade. They have some money to deal with. They would be the most logical choice, and they might have enough money to be able to pay Roy Halladay long term, because they are not going to give up three young players for Halladay and then lose him to free agency after the 2010 season. I think they're an option. The Cardinals, who don't have as much money to deal with, are another option. They're very resourceful when it comes to making big deals like this. And the team on the outside is the Dodgers. The Dodgers haven't been to the World Series since 1988. They really need to get back. Roy Halladay is the kind of guy who can turn them from the best team in baseball right now to a team that would be almost guaranteed to get to the World Series with his acquisition, and they too have young players to give up.
The Phillies became just the second team to have four players with at least 20 home runs before the All-Star break. The defending champs are in first place in the National League East. And this week, former Cy Young Award winner Pedro Martinez announced that he was talking, or at least his agent was talking, with the Phillies. Can Martinez help them at this point?
I think he can, because I think Pedro Martinez, even though he hasn't pitched since last year, is still another resourceful pitcher who can find ways to win even this late in his career and even without his great stuff.
After underachieving last season, the Tigers are in sole possession of first place in the AL Central. Are they pretty well positioned for a strong run in the second half of the season, or do they have to reload?
Bill, they have completely rebuilt their pitching staff and their defense right in front of our eyes. They've done it with young pitchers and kind of small-time acquisitions and position changes, but everything works well there now with Adam Everett at shortstop, Brandon Inge at third, Rick Porcello, a young guy in the rotation. A lot of things have changed, and I think the Tigers are the clear now team to beat in that division.
Texas and the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim are in a tight race in the AL West. Are the Rangers for real this year, or do the Angels keep their division crown?
Well, I think the Angels are going to win the division, but I think the Rangers are for real. I think they've really turned the corner this year in this respect. As a team that for virtually the entire time in their 37-year franchise history has been completely offense-dominated, they have finally decided we can't win without pitching. Nolan Ryan, who's their club president, one of the best pitchers of all time, basically said, "We're going to do this differently, fellas, and it starts right now." And they have pitched so much better this year than they have in recent years. I think it goes to the end, but I think the Angels win.
Tim, Thursday night, San Francisco Giants starter Tim Lincecum had a rough night by his standards. He lost a no-hitter in the seventh inning against the Padres, and he had his scoreless innings pitched streak stopped at a mere 29. Sure, he got his 10th win, but he's pretty well washed up, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I'm really worried about him. And by the way, Bill, if you haven't seen him up close, you really need to see him up close, because you would never in your wildest dreams believe that he's an athlete, let alone a Major League Baseball player, let alone the reigning Cy Young winner, let alone a guy who throws 97 miles an hour. Randy Johnson saw him this spring for the first time really up close and said, he looks like one of the Jonas Brothers. I mean, he is really a young-looking kid, to the point his rookie year he told me that he had trouble getting into several clubhouses on the road because the guys who was running the clubhouse didn't believe he was a major league player. He had to say, I'm a pitcher on the team.
The St. Louis Cardinals are atop the National League Central, but there are four teams still within striking distance of them. Any true challengers among the Brewers, Cubs, Astros, and Reds? And boy, I hope you say Cubs, because it sure is time.
It is time, Bill. I root for the story only, and I'm a little tired of the Cubs having won in 101 years. It is really time to change the subject, as it was with the Red Sox in 2004. I'm really starting to wonder. I keep saying they're going to hit it. They're going to hit their stride and win 17 out of 20, and it just hasn't happened yet. I still think there's a chance, but if you ask me now, I think the Cardinals are going to win that division, and I think Albert Pujols is the reason why. And I cannot wait to see if Albert Pujols is the first Triple Crown winner in the National League since 1937.
The aforementioned All-Star break begins on Monday with a game on Tuesday night. Busch Stadium in St. Louis is hosting this year's festivities, and Red Sox knuckleballer Tim Wakefield will be making his first appearance as an All-Star at the age of 42. So what do they call him when he shows up in the clubhouse? Rook?
Bill, this is why I love baseball so much. I don't care how corny this is. This guy is 42 years old, okay? And because he throws that quirky, funny little pitch, nobody gives him any credit for what he's doing. I am so pleased for him and for knuckleballers everywhere that he made the All-Star team. And I think it would be a wonderful thing for baseball if the starting pitchers in the All-Star game were Tim Lincecum, who's about 5'2", and Tim Wakefield, who's 42 years old, throwing a knuckleball. That would be the greatest tribute to the game, is a little guy and an old guy starting against each other in the All-Star game. And no matter what anyone tells you, it's really, really hard to throw that pitch. And Tim Wakefield does it really, really well.
Tim Kirkjian covers baseball for ESPN and joins me from time to time to talk about Sam. Tim, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
The WNBA's 13th season has entered its second month. The Indiana Fever are dominating the Eastern Conference, and last year's expansion team Atlanta Dream have already racked up more wins than they had during the entire 2008 season. The defending champion Detroit Shock has won three league championships in the past 6 years, which makes their 2-7 start this season all the more, well, shocking. But as Only a Game's Ron Schachter reports, the Shock aren't ready to give up just yet.
In the first third of the WNBA season, the Detroit Shock has absorbed a series of setbacks they couldn't have imagined after sweeping San Antonio for the 2008 WNBA title. Center Kara Braxton began the 2009 campaign with a league-imposed six-game suspension for a DUI conviction, and injuries sidelined star forward Cheryl Ford and Plynette Pearson. But the biggest bump in this season's road was the sudden resignation last month of head coach and general manager Bill Laimbeer, who turned the team from worst to first when he joined the Shock in 2003. Laimbeer left the team in the hands of assistant coach and former Pistons teammate Rick Mahorn. Perry Farrell covers the Shock for the Detroit Free Press and says that Laimbeer's leave-taking left something to be desired.
Well, they were 1-2. Third game into the season, and he said at his press conference he probably should have never started the season. So it sounds like Bill probably should have resigned after they won the title, which would have gave this crew a chance to start training camp with Ricky in place and go from there. So the timing was kind of awkward.
Some fans are more critical of Laimbeer, who's currently trolling for work in the NBA's coaching ranks, and the Shock's 2-7 record, good for last place in the WNBA's Eastern Conference. Laimbeer left behind a team created in his own tough guy image, forged as the 6'11" center for the NBA champion Detroit Pistons during the 1980s and 90s. Guard Katie Smith arrived in a trade 4 years ago.
He goes out
and finds people that fit his mold and fit his style. And I think he does, you know, try to put a team together what he was used to when he played for the Pistons, the kind of attitude, the kind of work ethic, the kind of unselfishness. So, you know, he goes out and finds people that are a little edgy, people that other coaches maybe, you know, don't want or, you know, have that little fire to them. And he doesn't back away from it.
7-year Shock veteran Cheryl Ford, who's back to full strength after knee surgery, says that the massive Mahorn, Laimbeer's bruising partner in the Pistons' front court, has carried on the tradition of toughness.
We do our little pregame stuff with Rick. He's banging on us and stuff, and that's what it takes, because that's how we're going to get done in the game. We're going to get hit. We're going to get banged on. We just got to, you know, stay focused and try to finish a shot.
Smith and fellow guard Deanna Nolan lead Detroit with 13-point scoring averages. But the Shock have long been known for their hard-nosed defense, inspired by Laimbeer and Mahorn. Shock season ticket holder Sophia Lafayette grew up rooting for them and sees their influence on the Shock players.
It shows in their ability, no matter what, every single play, they're going after the ball, they're fighting. They're able to play a level of defense that sometimes just borders on... I don't want to say football, but I mean, they are aggressive. They go after that ball, and they just know how to get it done.
That aggressiveness reached a new level last July at home against the Los Angeles Sparks. On the same court where the Pistons and Indiana Pacers had famously duked it out in 2004, the Shock engaged in a highly publicized brawl of their own that led to the suspensions of 4 Detroit players, but catalyzed a late-season run to the league title. And despite the Shock's 1-5 record on his watch, Mahorn says, essentially, there's no crying in basketball.
When we started the season, 4 of our 5 people that we wanted on the court were hurt and injured. So we've been dealing with the injury bug, but yet we just got to come on there with the competitiveness to say that nobody's feeling sorry for you. We're the champions, and we have a bullseye on our back.
Two Sundays ago, the Shock gave Mahorn and the home crowd a glimpse of their capabilities as they flummoxed Sacramento with an array of steals, fast breaks, and offensive rebounds leading to easy layups. After racing to a 47-28 halftime lead, the Shock fended off a Monarchs comeback to win 86-72. The result was a marked contrast to fourth quarter collapses in several recent losses. Katie Smith says that staying consistent is the key to getting back in the Eastern Division race.
We just want to be in the top 4 in the East, and that's something that's doable. But we do need to change. We need to compete in with the energy for 40 minutes. And the league's too good to come into the game and play 30 good minutes, because that means you're going to get beat. So it's a challenge, but you know what? We like challenges here.
The Shock face their next challenge tonight when they visit the Connecticut Sun. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. It is what it is, said International Federation of American Football President Tommy Wyking, and what it is, or rather what it was a ridiculous mismatch. In 3 games at the Federation's recent championship, the U.S. team scored a total of 174 points and gave up 3. In the most lopsided of the games, the U.S. beat the team from France 78-0. Tommy Wyking said the International Federation of American Football would apply before 2012 to get International Olympic Committee recognition for football, which he hopes will one day be an Olympic sport. Mr. Wyking hopes for closer games at next year's World Championships, though the early line has the U.S. giving 112 points to France. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, why it might be a good time to pick up a set of golf clubs. But first, it's the biggest weekend of the year for women's golf, the U.S. Open at the Saucon Valley Country Club in Pennsylvania, and most fans aren't paying attention to tour leaders making a very difficult course look easy, or even to the 14-year-old amateur who was just two strokes off the lead after the first round. No, those who are paying attention to women's golf are currently focused on outgoing LPGA Commissioner Carolyn Bivens and what's gone wrong with the tour. Sports Illustrated senior writer Alan Shipnuck joins me now on the line. Alan, welcome to Only a Game.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
Let's go back a little less than a week to July 5th when this was all set in motion. What happened?
Well, that was the day that my colleagues at Golf.com broke a story that there'd been a gathering of top players at that week's tour stop. And it was about 15 women, including all the biggest names, and it was basically a chance to air their various grievances and concerns with the leadership of Carolyn Bivens, the LPGA commissioner. Out of that, a letter was written that was sent to the board of directors that some of the players, but not all, signed, essentially asking for a change in the leadership and for Bivens' resignation. And that sort of started the death watch on her tenure as commissioner. And it was a stormy 4 years with her running the tour, and it's come to a pretty noisy end here. But there's a lot of unresolved issues that she's leaving behind, and whoever steps in the job is going to have a big task in front of them.
Certainly the players do have cause for concern. The LPGA has lost seven tournaments since 2007. Six other events are apparently without a major sponsor. Are the players right that this is worse than simply the effects of a bad economy?
Women's golf, the LPGA Tour, is always vulnerable because there's no Tiger Woods on that tour, and if a company's looking to cut back their sponsorship dollars, the LPGA's historically been hit hardest. But Bivens had a very specific vision when she came in as commissioner. She was the first female commissioner, but more importantly, she came from outside of the tour firmament, and what she wanted to do was take the LPGA into the big time and really raise the purses for the players and have a much bigger and splashier TV presence. And one of the real keys to her whole plan was the 2010 season. That's when the new TV contract would take effect. And she was able to nail down the contract with the Golf Channel, which is a huge coup for the tour. The other component was to have a bunch of tournament sponsor contracts expire this year. She could renegotiate for 2010, the new TV deal in hand, and she'd be in a great position. And the plan was working until, you know, we sort of had this global economic meltdown, and suddenly all these companies were pulling back. Bivens' ultimate downfall was that she clung to this vision, and she kept making more and more demands of these sponsors, even as the economy was tanking. And she held the line, and ultimately she probably lost her job because of her belief in the tour.
A failed proposal to require foreign players to take English lessons was Bivens' most publicized mistake, but was it her worst mistake?
Well, it was symbolic of her tenure in that she kind of charged ahead without thinking through the consequences, and she kind of had a tin ear for public relations. And, you know, ultimately it was kind of no harm, no foul. They took the proposal off the table. No one was ever suspended for lack of being conversant in English, and it basically was just a big media spectacle that didn't have much effect on the tour, but it was another strike against her. I mean, one in a long list of media missteps, and that all fed into her ouster, kind of not having strong relationships with the people that cover the tour, so they were always happy to treat her like a pinata whenever she made a mistake, and not soliciting feedback from the players, so they felt somewhat out of the decision-making process. And there was a series of little things like that that over time really kind of clouded her vision of what the tour could be.
Can Carolyn Bivens point to anything that she's done as a commissioner and say, here I succeeded?
I think so. The Golf Channel contract takes effect next year is really important for the tour. They've always been on a mishmash of different cable channels. The other thing, you know, the LPGA's for a long time went to small markets, small tournaments, kind of these mom-and-pop towns like Corning, New York, or Springfield, Illinois, and some of these small tournaments were going to go by the wayside anyway. And, you know, Bivens has really made the tour much more international. Some of the American players don't like having to travel to Asia and to South America and other places, and that's some of the grumbling. But from a global perspective, it's great for the tour's brand. So she did some good things, for sure. And, you know, she might have gone down as the greatest commissioner in the history of the LPGA if not for sort of some macroeconomic things are out of her control.
In the short term, next year's schedule is uncertain, and the recent player revolt certainly has to put off candidates for the job, prospective candidates. I'm not sure who would want to take over the reins of the LPGA right now, but who's in the running, and what will the new commissioner have to do to get things back on an even keel?
Well, you know, the player revolt, it cuts both ways, because, you know, they're private contractors. They don't have a union. They work for themselves. Them to come together, make a statement like they did, I mean, it just tells you how invested the players are in the tour's success. So in some ways, the next commissioner will step into a good position where the players are desperate to help the tour succeed, and they'll give a lot back. There's various names that have been talked about. I think they'll name an interim commissioner. I threw out the name Judy Rankin, who's, you know, a Hall of Fame player and a broadcaster. Jan Stevenson, a very prominent player for, you know, three decades. She's kind of raised her hand and said she'd like to do it. I think it'll be someone like that whose only job will be to get some of these sponsors back on board, make some concessions in the negotiations, and just try and secure next year's schedule. And then they can bring in, they'll have more time to search for, a younger, more energetic, visionary type to maybe come in next year. But whoever it is going to come in with a much more conciliatory tone, and, you know, I think they'll be greeted by open arms. All the companies do business with LPGA, and all the players are going to be happy to see him or her.
Alan Shipnuck is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated. Alan, thank you very much for joining me.
My pleasure. Thanks for the time.
For millions of Americans, golf is a beloved hobby, a way to relax, a maddening addiction, or all of the above. But unless your name is Tiger, Phil, or Michelle Wee, it's probably something you can do without. And that's one reason the economic downturn is affecting the sport. Only a Game's Doug Tribou has our story.
Crown Point Country Club in the small town of Springfield, Vermont, is one of nearly 16,000 golf courses in the United States. And according to the National Golf Foundation, one of more than 9,000 non-municipal courses that accept members and are open to the public for a daily fee. Lori Cobb has been a member for 10 years, and she's seen the effects of a down economy.
Yeah, I've got some friends who couldn't come back this year, who are living on retirement income, and it's too hard. I think when you do the math, you really have to play a lot of golf. And so if you don't play a lot of golf, then you have to have disposable income.
Crown Point's golfing fees fall in the low to middle range for U.S. courses. 18 holes with a cart on weekend mornings will run you $69, and a single membership for people 36 and older costs a little more than $1,000. Crown Point opened in 1953, and most of the golfers here today believe its history, modest prices, and steady function business put the club in a good position to weather the economic downturn. Golf.com deputy editor David Dusek agrees.
Local courses that tend to be more expensive and cater to business outings and corporate work, they're going to feel the pinch much more than golf courses that cater to, quote-unquote, the average Joe or the people who just simply want to go out and play on any given Saturday.
On the sixth hole at Crown Point, Steve Sinone is preparing to tee off. He owns a vacation home in Vermont and plays public courses here, but he's also a member of a private club near his home in South Windsor, Connecticut. Sinone says since the economic downturn, he's noticed physical changes at some courses.
I think a lot of courses have cut back on their mowing and allowing more fields and things to grow in certain areas, just to cut back from a gas perspective and just an overall maintenance cost.
But always being in the fairway, that's not a problem for you.
Exactly.
There are more than 4,400 private golf courses in the U.S., and like Sinone's home course in Connecticut, many are experiencing sharp membership declines. Shaker Ridge Country Club is in Loudonville, New York, just outside of Albany. The club lost 48 of its 318 members from last year, almost all of them citing financial concerns. Shaker Ridge president Frank Scotty says it was the largest one-year drop in club history.
Everybody's affected. Public courses in this area, their rounds of play are down. This is money that you use for fun, and now with these times, you have to be careful in what you're doing with your money.
Scotty says the club's board recognized the trend early last season and made adjustments, including eliminating the $3,000 initiation fee for 2009.
We didn't even bother figuring that in our budget this year. We knew it wasn't going to happen. We started our membership drive last August for this year. We actually gave membership free for the remainder of the year, starting in September.
Scotty says 35 new members joined Shaker Ridge this year for a net loss of 13. Some of the new additions are social members, however, and pay about a fifth of the more than $4,400 price of a single golfer's membership, so the club is still aggressively recruiting. Golf.com's David Dusek says it's a common story at private clubs all over the country.
There are a lot of different facilities that are at the mid to lower range of the private facilities that are waiving initiation fees or waiving food and beverage minimums, you know, for the next 10 years and making all kinds of different things to try and get members in.
While private courses may be suffering, the current economy is hitting resort golf courses even harder, and fewer rounds translate to less revenue from hotel rooms, restaurants, and gift shops. Palm Springs, California, and its neighboring cities are home to about 120 courses in a 20-mile section of the Coachella Valley. Bob Gibson owns PalmSpringTeaTimes.com and has published a local golf guide for 20 years. Gibson says more than a quarter of the area's courses fall into the resort category.
The top courses depended heavily on corporate functions. People take over the whole golf course, that kind of thing. And those have really gone pretty much in the tank.
According to Gibson, the top-tier courses typically attract 45,000 paid rounds in a given year, but many are on pace for 10,000 fewer rounds this season. One possible bright spot is the country's more than 2,400 municipal courses. Owned by cities or towns, municipal courses typically offer low greens fees and easy access. Hillview Golf Course is owned by the town of North Reading, Massachusetts, a suburb of Boston. On weekends, Hillview charges $56 for 18 holes with a cart. Head golf professional Chris Carter says reasonable rates and the town's commitment to good maintenance have kept people coming back.
Maybe they choose to play 9 holes as to play in 18 holes, but here with our location, we have plenty of people looking to play the golf course, and if that group decides to only play 9 holes, we have a group waiting to play their spot in the back 9.
The National Golf Foundation estimates there are 28.6 million golfers in the U.S., slightly fewer than in the year 2000. However, the rounds played are down by nearly 10% in the same time period. Couple that with a golf course construction boom, the total number of courses has grown by more than 3,000 since 1990, and the competition for golfers and members becomes extremely intense. In the meantime, David Dusek says the tough economic times are creating some great golfing opportunities.
Fewer rounds played means there are more tee times available for people who do want to play, and usually at a lower price. So this may be the best time of all to go out and play golf.
According to the research firm Ibis World, revenues at U.S. courses and country clubs fell 0.7% last year to a little more than $23 billion. In a recent report, Ibis World predicts revenues will fall nearly 3% this year before showing a moderate uptick in 2010 and stronger growth in 2011. Most duffers will tell you golf has a strange power over those who play the game, and recession or no, a lot of people will be swinging away, including Queechee, Vermont resident Mary Beth Mandooney.
I'm going to play the same amount. I'm addicted. This is our summer vacation. We just golf all summer, so we put the money towards that.
For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribou.
Look around, see my friends all here. The same familiar faces that I've seen for years. There's not too much that we need to say. We just say hi and smile and we start to play. The tee shots fly and away we go. With some congratulations and a friendly joke. The sun comes up on the morning breeze. There's really not another place we'd rather be at the end of night.
You're listening to Only a Game. Playing on the pro tennis tour is exhausting, especially when you're a good enough player to go deep into most of the tournaments you enter. And when you're good enough to win both the singles and doubles tournaments at Wimbledon last weekend, by the end of the show, you're beat. So it was no surprise that when Serena Williams arrived at a press conference in Danvers, Massachusetts on Thursday prior to a world team tennis match, she looked as if she'd rather have been home with her feet up. When she was asked questions such as whether it was difficult to make the transition from the huge stage of Wimbledon to a modest WTT venue, her answers were short and sometimes unconvincing.
It's easy and it's fun and I'm excited to play.
When Serena Williams beat her sister in the Wimbledon singles final last weekend, she edged ahead of Venus 11 wins to 10 in major tournaments. I asked the champion whether it was kind of fun that she had beaten her sister about as often as it had gone the other way.
Oh, obviously I'd rather win every time, but, you know, you can't win every time against the toughest player on the tour.
Not even when that allegedly toughest player is not quite at her best. But enough about matters related to the quality of her play. Given that I only had a few moments to speak with Ms. Williams, I moved quickly to ask her opinion about a particular piece of news out of London. The acknowledgement by the tournament's organizers that they took into account the relative attractiveness of the female players when deciding who would get to play on center court. How did that extraordinary revelation strike Serena Williams?
I feel like I'm super hot. I don't think you can get better than my body, so let's face it, you know. And Maresmo and Safina on center court, and they're gorgeous girls too, so, you know, it's just stupid.
Thus speaketh one of the most dominant female tennis players of our time, or of any time. So take note, ye decision-makers at Wimbledon the Much Revered, and take note too, you clowns who've snickered about Serena Williams's weight. She's the champ, folks, and she doesn't just belong at center court. Right now, she owns it. Anybody who thinks otherwise, well,
it's just stupid.
If you pine for plentiful podcasts, please visit onlyagame.org and click on podcasts. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at avfx.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
What's that rumbling, grumbling noise? Is it the girls? Is it the boys? Someone's tummy is making sound. It can be heard for miles around.
In an eating contest that perhaps should never have happened. Wait a minute. Should any eating contest ever happen? Anyway, in an eating contest last Friday on Coney Island, three elephants named Bunny, Susie, and Minnie ate a great many more hot dog buns than three humans named Juliet, Tim, and Eric could consume. Describing the details of the competition would be exceedingly unpleasant, and so I won't. Suffice it to say that when the 143 hot dog buns consumed by the humans proved to be insufficient, contest organizers decried the result as, quote, a setback for humanity.
Somebody's hungry as a bear.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a group of film buffs pay homage to a dude who bowls. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a pulling together of the week's news that won't involve pulling the rug out from under anybody. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
We have reached the point in the Major League Baseball season where contending teams are thinking present and various also-rans are thinking future and offering up some of their better players for prospects. Whither Toronto pitcher Roy Halladay?
Anywhere he whither wants to go, apparently. This is the first serious dangling of this guy that Toronto's done. And there are apparently magnificent gift packages and lovely parting gifts being offered by the Red Sox, the Phillies, the Yankees, the Dodgers, and the Angels, apparently. The Red Sox are being encouraged by some overzealous of their radio talk show fans to essentially give the entire farm system, including the rights to McCoy Stadium in Pawtucket, to Toronto. I would throw a big old bucket of cold water on that.
Chicago Cubs, still looking for their first World Series title since 1908, have a new owner. So, does that change everything?
Yeah, they seem to have contracted a case of the rickets. Not funny, but
right
fast.
Along.
The Tribune Company is going to sell the Cubs' Wrigley Field and some other assets to Joe Ricketts, who founded TD Ameritrade. This, for the first time in an awfully long time, gets the Chicago Tribune's Cubs beat writers out from under a horrible conflict of interest. I'm sure they're pretty happy about that.
Numbers of NBA players have been changing teams recently, Charlie. Among them, Rasheed Wallace, late of the Detroit Pistons. He'll be playing for your Boston Celtics. Good fit?
Terrific fit. A couple of things. Number one, all children under the age of 18 will not be able to sit on the baseline under the Celtics basket and any home games, because between Rasheed Wallace and Kevin Garnett, you're going to have a Richard Pryor routine breakout every time the ball goes up and somebody blows a whistle. I think it's terrific. It's great. It's just what the Celtics need. The NBA, which a lot of people thought that NBA teams would just sort of strip themselves down to the bare bones waiting for the big old free agency market of next year. Instead, you've got dramatic improvements in Cleveland, dramatic improvements in Los Angeles, dramatic improvements with the Celtics, and I think Orlando has sort of been left in the dust a little bit.
Charlie, after Michael Phelps was disappointed with mere best-of-the-year times at the U.S. Swimming Nationals, I am happy to report that he finally broke another world record, this time in the 100-meter butterfly, so I guess we can all breathe a sigh of relief that Michael is back.
Yes, apparently his suspension for being a goofy guy didn't hurt his times at all.
Oops, spoke too soon. Yesterday, Phelps woke up with a sore neck, dropped out of his final event at the Nationals, so I guess he is a no-good pothead after all.
I think he's probably just has to get a better pillow. He seems to have woken up with a kink in his neck. And I guess now that I'm sort of doing the whole freestyle thing over here, that would be like a real career ender if you couldn't get rid of a kink in the neck.
You betcha.
Because you have to breathe, or so I'm told.
Suspended Sprint Cup driver Jeremy Mayfield is defending himself against NASCAR's contention that he tested positive for methamphetamines. I really have no idea what Mr. Mayfield may or may not have ingested, but I do find one of his points to be very intriguing. How exactly does NASCAR enforce its zero-tolerance drug policy without releasing a list of the banned substances even to the people who are being tested?
Well, let's all stipulate for the record that there is a list, and that methamphetamine is probably on it.
Probably.
Because it's not a great thing to be taking when you're driving 180 miles an hour, because it makes you think you're driving 980 miles an hour. That said, Mayfield certainly has a point, and he has quotes from a couple of the leading anti-doping experts, including Dr. Gary Wadler. They have actually questioned NASCAR policy of not releasing its list. Maybe NASCAR sort of classified everything except your sponsor, whatever your sponsor makes. You can use Royal Oak charcoal. That's okay.
You may have noticed, Charlie, during this year's fortnight at Wimbledon, some players who were easier on the eyes than others playing at center court, while players who were more highly regarded for their tennis skills were playing on the courts further away. I doubt you're surprised at how the poobahs make their decisions about who plays where, but were you caught off guard by their candor?
Yes, I was caught off guard by the fact that they admitted that, while London Daily Mail put it, a succession of quote-unquote easy-on-the-eye unknowns have appeared at center court, while some of the top seeds were way out in the boondocks. This is enormously disgusting and really stupid, and the fact that there are still people in the upper levels of British sport who will say this openly for the record and in print means that there's a tremendous house cleaning to be done over there.
On Wednesday, construction workers in South Africa went on strike just in time to threaten completion of the venues for the 2010 World Cup. You can't remember any other times where major sporting events were threatened by construction worker strikes, can you?
Look, large events of this kind, the World Cup, the Olympics, they all come with their own inherent baggage, no matter where you put them. People are a little bit nervous about South Africa, basically because at least a few people have told me that they're hoping that Nelson Mandela does not pass away before any of this happens, because the feeling is the country may come apart. That having been said, I mean, there are thousands of people who put down the tools. This is exactly the kind of thing can derail something like this.
We're accustomed to stories of retired athletes who've lost all their money, Charlie. It unfortunately happens frequently. But this week's bankruptcy filing of former center fielder Lenny Dykstra has reached new lows. I can't decide which is more surprising. that Mr. Dykstra has managed to accumulate between $10 and $50 million of debt on just $50,000 in assets, or that Mr. Dykstra is not sure whether he owes $10 or $50 million.
Well, you lose track after the 10th million, don't you? I mean,
don't ask me.
I mean, this is a this is a whopper. You know, there was a while where Lenny Dykstra was sort of the poster child for athletes who can make it big in the bull market. Of course, you know, the bubble burst and he went down with everybody else. I think he may well go back to playing poker for a living.
And finally, if a college student dunks on LeBron James and Nike confiscates the videotapes of said event, why does it make such a very loud noise?
You're LeBron James. Do you really care? Seriously.
This may cost
What's going to happen if they find out a college sophomore dunked on you?
I think it could cost him Lenny Dykstra money. Anything could happen here.
Anything could happen, but nothing would.
Charlie Pierce, who has never dunked on me, writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Good thing you got a hold of the tapes.
Barbara Hansen, a New Yorker who listens to the Only a Game podcast, was irked by one of the stories in last week's program. She emailed as follows: Keith O'Brien's story on the disappearance of newspapers and thus of local print sports coverage was so squirmily snarky on the subject of age that this 52-year-old nearly hurled her iPod across the room. He seemed staggered that a 54-year-old journalist whom he characterized as old would have the skills and savvy to operate in the digital world. Hey, Keith, I have uncles in their 80s who maintain Facebook pages. Perhaps it's you who needs to catch up with what today's digital world really looks like. Cheryl Houston, who hears the program on New Hampshire Public Radio, also had achievements by mature folks in mind when she emailed regarding last week's show to say, although it was nice to hear about Lance Armstrong, it would have been even better to include a story about Gene Longo, who at 50 is still cycling strong and has over 1,000 title wins to her credit. We all know about Lance. This woman is news. Gary Brandt, who hears Only a Game on WXXI in Rochester, New York, heard my reminiscence about how the papers covered baseball in my youth and wrote to say that it had brought back some memories of playing Name the Player with his friends on the ball field as they waited for more kids to arrive. We would imitate the batting stances of Willie Mays, Roger Maris, Nellie Fox, and so on, he wrote, and the windups of Lou Burdett, Warren Spahn, and Whitey Ford, and the throwing motions of Rocky Colavito, Hank Bauer, and Minnie Minoso. Sometimes the older kids would correct our imitations of a given player. The adult coaches, parents, and umpires knew nothing of this. It was our kids' game within a game. In my conversation with Charlie Pierce last week, Charlie wondered if a Wimbledon win by Andy Murray, a Scot, would really have constituted a victory for Britain. Kurt DiCamillo, Howard Burnham, and Christine Dowdswell were among the listeners who emailed to set Charlie right. Mr. DiCamillo wrote that, quote, all Scots, Welsh, and English are also British, so Andy Murray can correctly be called Scottish and British, just as Charlie can be called American and Worcesterite. Send your notes on geography or anything else to us via our website, onlyagame.org. Our address is Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. Simply say the names of certain characters from sports movies and a film reel's worth of memories spring to mind. Rocky, or for those who prefer the little guy, Rudy. Others aren't quite so memorable. Rod Tidwell is best remembered as that annoying football player played by Cuba Gooding Jr. Somewhere in between superstardom and obscurity is the dude for whom a 14-city Speed of Sound tour begins in Louisville this weekend. Only a Game's Charlie Schroeder has the story.
You don't have to afford to. That's with jellies, flip-flops, what have you.
It's 9:30 on a Friday night at Cow Bowl Bowling Alley near Long Beach, California. And Lebowski Fest co-founder Will Russell addresses a long line of Big Lebowski fans who wait patiently for a league night to end so they can come inside and do some bowling.
We get eight on a lane, so make friends and share lanes.
But Russell's speech is abruptly cut off when a Cow Bowl regular tells him to be quiet. League night isn't over yet, and Vernon Adams, a local sanitation worker who has nothing to do with the Lebowski Fest, is one strike away from a perfect string. Adams knocks over all 10 pins for a total of 300. His feat will be the night's greatest athletic achievement, by far. But most of the 900 Lebowski fans, or achievers as they're called, don't witness it. Most are in a line that extends outside and around the corner of the building. The ones already inside are hobnobbing with like-minded Lebowski fans. Many, like David Gerard, are dressed like their favorite character. Gerard, he's the dude, the movie's protagonist played to slothful perfection by an unkempt Jeff Bridges. Gerard wears a bathrobe, dark sunglasses, and sports long hair. He's a dead ringer for the dude and knows the movie inside and out.
I could do it line for line with the music. I could do it right now.
Could you really? What, can you just give me like the first five lines of the movie? Star Trek has its conventions, Rocky Horror its audience participation screenings, but the Coen brothers' 1998 film The Big Lebowski has its fest, a two-night celebration that culminates in this late-night bowling party. The dude's social life revolves around the sport, hence the location, and according to co-founder Will Russell, Cow Bowl is a better venue than the fest's first one, a Baptist-run alley in Russell's hometown of Louisville, Kentucky.
They wouldn't let us drink, and they wouldn't let us cuss. There was actually signs that said, no cussing, no drinking. Another sign that said, please read signs above all the signs.
Russell and co-founder Scott Shuffett originally held the Lebowski Fest as a joke, but the idea quickly caught on and has grown rapidly in its 7 years. This summer, there will be 15 fests from San Diego to Boston. Russell says as the ball keeps rolling, the fest just gets better.
I mean, it just continually gets weirder and more awesome and just bigger and crazier. And, you know, we just try to keep it ridiculous, and it seems to be working.
Consider the Reverend Oliver Benjamin, a.k.a. the Doodly Llama. He started Dudism, a religion based on the dude's character. He set up shop tonight in front of a row of lockers where he's ordaining Dudist priests. That's right, Dudist priests.
It means that you've basically committed yourself to following the way of the dude. You take her easy in all sorts of difficult situations, and you're basically a pretty nice guy to everybody. And you just don't take life that seriously.
So far, Benjamin's ordained 40,000 Dudist priests, all of whom became members of his church, the Church of the Latter-day Dude. The religion even has its own symbol, a modified version of the yin-yang. But instead of one dot inside each swirl, there are three, so it looks like a bowling ball. He tells me that Dudism and its tenets of low-impact living are more relevant today than ever.
One of the problems, one of the reasons that we're in these difficult, these dire straits, is because of conspicuous consumption and people investing in things just to make money rather than buying things they actually need.
Although the Coen brothers' dude might not be much of a consumer, that hasn't stopped organizers from selling T-shirts, posters, and bumper stickers printed with some of the movie's popular lines like, "Mind if I do a J?" and "Not on the rug, man," a reference to a beloved scene where an intruder urinates on the dude's favorite possession. And while the dude is a decidedly non-competitive dude, that hasn't stopped Lebowski Fest organizers from including numerous contests in tonight's festivities. There's a trivia contest held in Cow Bowl's karaoke bar.
What is the name of the restaurant that the dude and Walter have coffee at?
That's all you got? Johnny's.
That is correct. Good job.
There are also contests for most original costume and farthest traveled, in this case, London. But the grand finale is a one-frame bowling match between the contestants that most closely resemble the dude and three of the movie's supporting characters. After the dude and Walter lookalikes tie, it comes down to a bowl-off. The dude knocks down 9 pins. Then, it's Walter's turn.
Oh, got her ball!
Afterwards, I talk with the winner, dude lookalike Rick Unger, an artist who describes his work as improbable realism. He wears a big wool sweater and carries props from the movie, a briefcase, cell phone, and pager. If David Gerard was a dead ringer for the dude, Rick Unger just walked off the screen.
My brother saw the movie before I did. He says, you have to go see this movie. It's all about you. So I went to see the movie, and I went, oh, it's about this lazy old hippie. That is me.
But he's not lazy when it comes to looking like the dude.
My main competitor's name is Tom. Won in 2006. I won Best Dude here in 2007. Last year in San Francisco, he beat me because I was about 35 pounds heavier than I am now, and my hair was too long and it was blonde. And when I saw the pictures, I went, no wonder I lost. I looked more like Walter than I did the dude. So I lost the weight, cut my hair, and I'm back.
And now, at 2 in the morning, he carries with him the ultimate trophy for a dude impersonator, an oriental rug, just like in the movie. It's rolled up and tucked under his arm. And as Unger shuffles through the automatic doors into the empty parking lot, he keeps a firm grip on it. For Only a Game, I'm Charlie Schroeder in Lakewood, California.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Josh Levenshurz. And our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to see photos from the Lebowski Fest or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. In our final word, Tim Kirchin proves that he's not just a baseball expert. He's also the proud papa of a dandy high school basketball player.
When you see that the Orlando Magic shoot their way out of the NBA Finals because they can't make a free throw, my daughter, who's 3 feet tall, shooting from the same distance, made 54 out of 56 from the free throw line.
So I suppose it's no surprise I've got Gino Auriemma and Pat Summitt on the line with offer sheets, and I'll put them on hold here for a minute so I can say, I'm Bill Littlefield, thanks for listening. See you next week. Take a woman like your kind.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.